The Einleitung is the introduction of Deutsch.
This is Mae Warren. This is tape two with Jefferson Davis Butch III on August 19th, 1996. And actually, I guess it's tape three if we count Richards.
Yeah, this is the third tape this summer, but the second tape today. Yeah, I wanted to say something about a great campus character. In fact, I want to say something about his cremation and the disposal of his remains. Mr. Earl Stansberry Mattingly, who was the registrar as an undergrad, if you can imagine, an undergrad finding time also to be registrar. And then he did get his degree very belatedly and continued being registrar until 1940, and then he became treasurer from 40 until the mid-1960s. And if I recollect correctly, he died the week between Christmas and New Year's of 66. But because he had no family, he was unmarried, he lived a tennis ball's throw from the campus. He lived in what I think is now called the International House, next door to what was the Sigmund Chi House and is now Brian Shaw's PR office. Mr. Mattingly's life revolved entirely around the school, and he was undistracted by family, friends, or hobbies, as far as anyone knows. He was born as Ollie Crenshaw, one of his great detractors, used to call him, and turned his birth date into a nickname, Old 82888, August 28, 1888. Because of lack of money, Mr. Mattingly entered WNL, I believe, in 1915 at the age of 27. He was born on a farm in D.C., if you can imagine a farm, in the District of Columbia, on the site of the subsequent Walter Reed Hospital, Army Hospital, way out Georgia Avenue, 16th Street is one side, and I guess Georgia Avenue is the other side. So E.S. Mattingly, who would wind up rather affluent, came here as a poor boy of 27, a freshman, 27 years old, in 1915, which was not unusual in the late 19th and early 20th century, I guess. It did happen. And he was so academically, shall we say, challenged, that he couldn't graduate, I guess low grade, until 1925. And Ollie said that the graduation of 19, and that they were classmates, but Ollie, of course, graduated age 21 in 1925. He graduated on time. Maybe he entered a year late. Ollie was an undergrad for only 3 years and got his degree, 1922 to 1925. But anyway, he and Mattingly, who was then 37, going on 37 when he got his bachelor's degree, graduated simultaneously, the same ceremony, same day, in Lee Chapel, where these graduations were held in the 1920s. And Ollie said that a sarcastic round of cheers went up when Mattingly was given his diploma, as though to say, "You dumbbell, we knew you might make it, but here you've actually made it." So Mattingly had already been appointed registrar during his undergrad years, because he was in his 30s at that time. He turned 30 in the year 1918. And so he got his degree after being registrar, which today is inconceivable, obviously. But during those years when he was a student, apparently the faculty had said, "You nitwit, I'm giving you a D just to get you out of the course." And the professors apparently had been very impolite and sarcastic in their treatment of Mattingly. But once he got his degree and went on being an administrator after that, he did not hide his hatred for the faculty. And the faculty members, for example, who were very, very poorly paid in the 1920s and 30s, would run out of money before the end of the month and would come to Mattingly, this young man who they had been insulting for his academic shortcomings not so many years before. The roles were reversed now, and faculty members had to sit in his office with him, of course, behind his desk, and on the 25th of the month say, "Well, I would like an advance on next month's paycheck, because we don't get paid until the 31st of the month, and could you find it in your heart to do this?" And Mattingly would give them sort of Calvin Coolidge style lectures. If you would handle your money more responsibly, you wouldn't be put in a position like this. Certainly, I should think that a man of 50 years old with a doctorate of philosophy would be able to budget his funds for a 30-day period in order to get through the month, at least that. And so he took great delight in humiliating faculty members who, in some cases, had been embarrassing him once upon a time. And while Ali was never in that position, Ali did not come from a poverty-stricken family by any means. But Mattingly would sort of pinprick the faculty in other ways, turning off lights. And apparently Mattingly would roam the buildings late at night, having nothing else to do. And if Ali Crenshaw were working in his office and were leaving at 10 p.m. in Washington Hall, where his office was, and not turn off a hallway light, Mattingly might catch him at it and say, "Do you think this school has a $10 million endowment? It would certainly help if members of the faculty would turn off hall lights at this hour of the night." And so Mattingly went out of his way to be unpleasant to faculty members, according to Ali Crenshaw. To me, as a young faculty member, maybe he was certainly polite. Maybe it was because he did not equate the youngest of the faculty with his persecutors of once upon a time, but he was always very nice to me in a rather business-like way, but he wasn't unpleasant, certainly, at all, and once even took me to dinner, which apparently was like Jack Benny taking someone to dinner. It was once, in the first year or two when I was there, I didn't have a car for a number of years here in town, and so Mattingly pulled up alongside me when I was walking on Jefferson Street towards my rented room. The house was rented, where I had a rented room. And this great long Cadillac or whatever he had, it looked like a White House limousine. And I think it was the mark of success for a boy who had arrived in humble circumstances in 1915. And now it was almost half a century later. And he had a very fancy long black car. And it pulled up alongside me, and I, for a moment, I didn't know who it was at first. And the window was automatically taken down from the driver's seat, I'm sure. And I gathered somebody was trying to get my attention, so I looked in. It was Mr. Mattingly. He said, "Get in," rather brusquely like that, and I, of course, obeyed. And he said, "Have you had dinner yet?" And I said, "Well, no, actually, Mr. Mattingly, I haven't had dinner yet." He said, "I'll take you to dinner." So he was good-hearted, and late in life, perhaps, he was good-hearted. But there were many stories about other good-heartedness that in the 30s and 40s and 50s, that if he became aware that an undergrad was hurting for money, that the family had perhaps was not rich to begin with, or there was a family illness that had cut into the wealth of the family, Mattingly would either anonymously or in absolute confidence give the boy tuition money, and that many kids graduated in the middle of the century and before the middle of the century because of Mr. Mattingly's anonymous generosity. Mm-hmm. So, in spite of the fact that he came across as a very terse Calvin Coolidge-like austere character, he very much had his good side, and I thought being invited to eat with this man of proverbial rigor and severity was a compliment. I was very pleased at that, and he continued until his death. He did not have a long nursing home illness. He died after a short illness, maybe a week.
And you wanted to tell me about his cremation?
Oh, yes. Now I was told at the time that there was a city law that cremated remains could not be disposed of on lawns or in parks or in gardens or flower beds or any place like that. And yet, Mr. Mattingly, I found out many years later, had expressed a desire to be cremated and to have his ashes scattered on the lawn in front of Washington Hall. And when I came back from Christmas holiday in the December 66 holiday, came back, I guess, in the first days of January, learned that Mr. Mattingly had died a week earlier. And so I asked a question about, well, was he buried in Stonewall Jackson Cemetery? And was told, no, he was cremated. I said, well, I guess his ashes are there. And someone said, I don't think so. And people began talking in sort of, again, circumlocutious ways about the ashes. And I eventually found out, though not easily and not quickly, that the ashes were illegally scattered on the grass in front of Washington Hall, city law or no city law, and that there are thus now the remains, the ashen remains of at least two faculty members there. Did Richard tell you the other story about the professor whose ashes were put there?
I've heard that.
Yeah, 15 years later. Yeah,
yes.
The young man who committed suicide.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
And I think on New Year's Day of 81, if I'm, or am I deceived? Maybe it was New Year's Day of 82 that he committed suicide. But we have in the soil of the front lawn.
No wonder the grass is so green.
Yes, Mr. Matt. Yes, indeed. These two loyal, they love the school so much that they both requested this. And of course, by the time the younger man was put in the lawn, apparently the city law had either become a dead letter or had been repealed. But in the 1960s, it was still a delicate matter to deposit Mr. Mattingly's remains in the wintertime grass.
Now, you made a mention a while ago about, just in passing, about turning off lights late at night.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there's quite a lot of activity on this campus late at night, that faculty members keep late office hours?
I know of one faculty member, I don't know of many, or of two even, but I know of one faculty member who is, like me, a bachelor and keeps hours into the wee hours of morning, as I do at home. But I don't want to particularly run into the night watchman at 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. But there is one of the professors who is here now and has been here for many years, who is said to be a late night creature on campus, yes.
And you keep office hours at home?
No, I mean...
Oh, you would keep late hours at home?
I grade exams
into
the wee hours at my house, but not in the office. No, I keep normal office hours, the same daytime office hours that other people keep. And I don't know why, some little intuition told me that hanging around campus in the wee hours of the night is not a standard thing for professors to do, so I don't do it. No, I don't have students at my house, because my house looks like a landfill. Or the wreckage of the Titanic, or now the wreckage of TWA. So I can't have any visitors in my house, ever. But I have office hours in the daytime. Harold, your question was about this person who has office hours literally in the middle of the night. And I think if when he's not having office hours, he's grading exams or planning a lecture or something like that. I don't say he has students coming in every night.
This is only one person.
Only one person, yes.
Oh, I got the impression there was a beehive of activity around in the night.
Well, there may be, but I know of only one person who does this. Sort of an eccentric, beloved but eccentric person who has these very late hours. But I have never done that, and I don't know of any others who have office hours late at night. Most people, most Americans, I guess, are TV zealots, and most people want to be at home watching the tube at night. So I would be surprised. Now, I have heard, with regard to the faculty, I'd be very surprised. I have heard that amorous students are often a prowl in various buildings in the wee hours for reasons having little to do with scholarship, for reasons having nothing to do with scholarship, but that has nothing to do with the faculty.
I've seen signs to that effect.
Oh yes, student hanky pank is reportedly quite active.
Do you have any good stories about that?
Mm-hmm. I don't know any. Students are very discreet about their personal lives. with faculty members. And it's very probable that I know kids who misbehave in campus buildings in the wee hours, but of course they wouldn't tell faculty members that. So I can only imagine and envy them very much that when I was a student, I was a goody-goody and lived in the same town, always went home on the bus to my parents, and I never misbehaved. But of course these kids' parents are a long way off, and I can well imagine that that students take advantage of empty buildings at 1 a.m.
Well, are there any other stories you'd like to tell? What do you want to be remembered for here at Washington and Lee?
For longevity.
Well said.
Thank you. I don't know. Other than for having an extremely long career, I would like to be remembered for keeping the kids awake and alert in class.
What classes do you really enjoy teaching?
Well, I guess Venice and the Papacy most, because, which are spring semester courses, because Venice is a city that I came to love by roaming through it street by street and alley by alley in my youth. And the Papacy, because there is no institution more, what shall we say, more heavily chronicled with scandal than the Papacy. So when you have a combination of scandal and art, it's a wonderful recipe. So while I know that you can't refer in your book to the scandal-ridden nature of papal history, that's what I enjoy about it. I suppose in a book, if this is quoted at all, you could say that the artistic history of Rome and the role of the popes as the greatest art patrons of Western civilization, that I enjoy that. But Antoine knew the popes were just wild men in bygone times, less in the 20th century, and in the 19th century pretty bland also. But that's a wonderful course. And I don't know if the students think it's wonderful. I enjoy teaching it. And as I say, Venice is a city I fell in love with from photographs when I was in high school, and then was lucky enough to get stationed there in the Army, stationed on the mainland right outside of Venice. So every weekend for 2 years, I went to Venice.
Oh, aren't you lucky?
And well, yeah, how about that? It was an incredible break. I mean, some people get stationed on Korean hilltops waiting for the North Koreans to come back, and I got stationed next door to Venice. And it was a quick train ride to the city, and I learned it, learned the ins and outs of Venice and its history and its architecture and art collections and so forth very thoroughly. So I have never gotten bored, have never fallen out of love with Venice. So it's a wonderful course to teach.
So do you think your teaching style has changed through the years?
Only in one respect. And off-color anecdotes cannot be told in a co-ed class. But I don't think otherwise it's changed, no. There were many more off-color anecdotes prior to 1985, but or I guess I didn't have any female freshmen at that time. But I don't think I taught freshmen in 85, because there was a period when freshman history enrollments may have been down. And I taught the freshman sophomores early in my career. Then there was a period when they said, well, we can get other people to do it, you don't have to. And then the enrollments may have picked up, because I've been teaching freshmen again in the last 6 or 7 or 8 years. I forget when. You'll be glad to know, everyone will be glad to know, I don't keep a diary, so I don't know exactly when, so I don't think I had any female freshmen at that time. But in a mixed class, one can't tell smutty stories. But that's the only change that I have made.
So why are you depriving the girls of your best stories?
Oh, because I don't want a young lady to go to my bride, who never was. The hyphenated lady to say, he told a story about Marie Antoinette and so and so, or he told a story about Queen Victoria's daughter-in-law who did this or that. And I'd get a deep doo-doo, as George Bush would say, deep doo-doo. So, of course, that's a case where I would have to be very careful, because one never knows when somebody might take offense at something.
And male students never took offense at anything?
Oh, no. Well, who knows? Maybe the Sunday school type of male student just didn't take my courses.
Because one thing I was impressed by was I interviewed, and you can stop me if I'm going over the line of what we said we wouldn't talk about, but I interviewed some of the first women students who went through here. Of course, this was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really struck at how similar they seem to be to the guys who go here.
Yes, that's what I
agree with
that.
They seem to be the same kinds of people.
Yes, that's very true. Many people have remarked on the same thing. And of course, a lot of the faculty members have been unhappy about that because they wanted female students who would be male haters and say men are all brutes and rapists and monsters and devils and patriarchal oppressors. And of course, the young ladies who have been here in the last 10 years very seldom, if ever, say that kind of thing. And they will say, well, I'm not a feminist. And they are very, you're exactly right. You're very perceptive, as always, to say that. So this is not an imaginary similarity at all. I fully agree with you on that. So, of course, I've had a number of them in my class, and there are no problems at all. But I still can't tell an off-color story in class because there could be just one person who, one female student who's on a different wavelength, and there would be H to pay if I told a story. I mean, there are many stories, not about Queen Victoria, I hasten to add, but say the wife of George IV was a nymphomaniac. But if I said in class that that Queen Caroline was a nymphomaniac, somebody might go to the hyphenated future bride, and say he was holding a woman, a female in history up to ridicule. So I can't. There's no way I can run that kind of risk. So I simply say that that George IV and his wife were both morally dubious, and that each one was a great cross that the other had to carry, something of that sort, and just sort of pass quickly over anything else, or just mention George IV alone, and of course about him, who was he was a sex athlete, increasingly fat as the years went by, and he was not a Brad Pitt. But of course, I would say anything, the male character, the male scandalous characters in history are seldom a problem. But one has to tailor the French call the chronique de scandale. One has to tailor that a little more carefully now. But otherwise, my think, getting back to your original question, I think my teaching is the same, essentially the same as it always was. And I'm inspired in that respect by a philosophy professor I had over 40 years ago at Johns Hopkins, who was a very entertaining professor. And he is my unacknowledged model, long dead, of course, now. But he was a very delightful lecturer. And I remember him better than anybody else in my undergrad days. And he's the one I've attempted with who knows what success to emulate, Professor George Boas of the philosophy department. So nobody fell asleep in his class.
Well, I don't think they do in yours
well,
either.
Well, thank you. My goal is not to have them fall asleep.
Well, let me ask you about, I was here before, and then I left, and then I've come back.
Yes, I do remember your
first from what I understand. Well, certainly what I witnessed in the late 70s when I was here, I was not in the classroom, but I was in Lexington, and I did not see a lot of gentlemanly behavior in the late 70s around
you
here.
You mean at night or out in the town or on campus or what?
I mean walking by Red Square on a Wednesday night.
Drunk? Were they drunk?
Drunk and just
relieving
very
themselves?
Unruly behavior.
On the sidewalk,
I would say.
Something like that?
And
or sort of breaking glass that cars, automobile tires would.
Yeah, but all that kind of thing. I mean,
be,
it was just
be damaged by
very loud music all the time, and just and I wasn't necessarily an older person who would be offended by these things, but
mere,
it was just
a mere high school mate at that time.
Not quite. I wish, but not quite. But from what I understand, part of the reason why coeducation was brought here was because the academic standards had been lowered, that the students who were coming through here weren't quite as good. Did you experience that?
No, I did not experience that. I think that a lot of the defenders of coeducation wanted to make it appear that they were academic deadheads, or dunderheads, deadhead I guess has another meaning now, dunderheads. And there may have been some dunderheads here at the time, but there also were in the 60s, I guarantee you. Mm-hmm. And some of the brightest kids that I know were here in the late 70s. So I think that a somewhat distorted picture is deliberately painted of that period in order to give alumni and trustees at the time a reason to go co-ed. It has always been a suspicion of mine that, of course, obviously I can't prove this or footnote. This was faculty members, let's don't talk to me much. That there could have been a lowering of the quality of high school kids who were let in here. I mean, history is not a tough subject to teach. Maybe if I taught math or physics, it would have been more noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
But the material history is so familiar to start with, and it's easy to read, and it's not like physics or calculus or computers. I heard somebody say this once, and I have never forgotten it, that they deliberately let in some high school boneheads in order to be able to tell the trustees, we are facing a crisis of the quality of kids who are coming here, and we are going to eventually have nothing but morons here, and the trustees say, oh dear, we don't want that to happen. What's the solution? And the administration said, well, admitting female students would probably change things very much. And the trustees said, well, we don't much want to do that. And the admissions people said, well, it's that or simply apes and gorillas will be here. Just people with no IQs at all, no detectable IQs will be the students 10 years from now. And the trustees said, well, we don't want that to happen either. And that something of this sort may well have happened. And I'm convinced that it did happen, but I cannot possibly prove that. The ones that I got in that period seemed to be perfectly okay. And if you look at if anybody looks at the alumni magazine and looks at the graduates of 1979, 1980, 1981, 82, then you'll see they're having very successful careers. And it has been said also that there's no A, you know, the letter grade A, in the word success. And that it is quite easy to be academically weak and still run a company or found a company or step into dad's shoes and take over the family business quite successfully. So if the graduates of the late 70s and early 80s had turned into B.V. derelicts, then I would say, huh, yeah, there was really something wrong with the quality, because these guys are all sort of leaning on buildings in B.V., which is not the case. And so I'm very skeptical about the academic assertions that are made and the reasons for any academic falling off in that period. Now, as for their wild behavior, I think that has something to do with the fact that the student, or what's it called, the student control committee or whatever took care of disciplinary problems, might have been very lax. And what John B. Wilson did was to set up a fraternity system that is very, very tightly managed, so that the vandalizing of fraternity houses, the destruction of furniture, the breaking of glass windows and things like that, that there is such a tight rein on the fraternities that wild behavior is, that wild behavior comes with a cost. That if a wild fraternity party takes place and the frat house is damaged by hurling full bottles of whiskey against a wall or a door or something like that, that there's an immediate financial penalty, because a penalty is assessed. And mom and dad will find that the monthly bill for fraternity dues is doubled or is increased in some way.
I need to turn the tape over.